everyone, to another episode of Mention and Dispatches. It's the podcast for the Armchair Dragoons. As always, I'm Brant. I'm your host. I'm, you know, to say I'm the ringmaster implies that there's some sort of order to all of this, which is not a great assumption on anybody's point, on anybody's part. Tonight, we've got joining us the brain trust behind the OTS crew, the On Target Sims crew, who are, you know, world renowned at this point for the Flashpoint campaign series, and frequent members of our Origins crew also. So, from left to right on your podcast dial, we have Jim Snyder, known as Captain Darwin around our forums. Howdy, Jim.
Good evening at this point.
You know, we say good evening because that's when we record these podcasts. We have no idea when people are listening. It could be good morning. Like, it's fine.
See, it's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Yes. Yes, it is. We also have Jeff is with us. Jeff, how you doing tonight?
Great. How are you? Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. And Jeff, you're registered as Iron Mike Golf on pretty much like all of your forums anywhere,
yeah, pretty
right?
much. Yep.
Yeah. It's like I'm banned at Brant anywhere you're going to try and find me on the web. It just makes things easier for people to find you. You know, be consistent. Really quick, I've never asked, were you a Mike Golf on the tanks or on the Brads?
Us Bradley Master Gunner.
Okay.
And so the Iron Mike Golf, I'm a Mike Golf, and that's Master Gunner. Iron was my last persona on active duty that was at 1st Armored Division.
Okay. Yep. So Divisional Master Gunner for the Bradleys?
That's correct.
Yep. Yep. See?
Which meant I got everything like 50 cal. Well, the tanker had the 50 cals, but I had like all the other small arms, marksmanship stuff.
Yeah, you see, guys like you and me can parse that, and there's probably about a third of our audience that might figure out what we're talking about, and the rest of them are like, huh? But like, they no context for them to fully grasp it, so. And then our token Canadian, because it seems we can't go through a podcast without a Canadian anymore, we've got Rob from North of the Wall. Rob, how are you?
I'm doing great, Brant. Thanks for having us aboard tonight.
Hey, no problem. Hey, Rob, I got to ask, has the existential angst over the Maple Leaf started to set in yet?
Oh, low blow. Yes, of course, it's always there. But yes, this year they're going to go all the way. No question.
As of this recording, hockey season isn't even a week old, and Maple Leafs fans are already starting to melt down because they're not winning every game 10-0.
It's complicated.
By the way, those of us down here in Carolina really appreciate y'all letting Jake Gardner walk, because we were able to sign him down here, and he's already got a couple of goals under his belt. So thank you. We do appreciate that. It was nice of you to send him our way, and at below market value, which is even better. So. That was very sweet.
In the grand scheme of things, it will all balance out. You know, the karma goes both ways. I'm sure, you know, the U.S. will do something like that for us someday. It'll be wonderful.
Perhaps. In the meantime, I'm going to sit here and revel in the fact that North Carolina has a Stanley Cup, in the last 30 years, and Toronto does not. So.
Yep.
Ouch.
What can I say? Our time's coming. Just you wait.
Perpetually. So.
Yeah.
All right. So to the business at hand of talking to you guys about the actual Flashpoint campaigns games, there is one key question that everybody out there wants to know. Jim, when the hell's the game coming out?
That's a good question. No, we're hoping to have it out probably late first quarter, early second next year. Things are progressing, not as fast as we'd all like, but, you know, we've all unfortunately got, work and day lives and families and those other things that kind of get in the way of doing, you know, computer gaming work.
How tough can your day job be? I mean, it's not rocket science or anything, is it?
In my case, yeah, it is, but, I think it's going well. We've managed, if you go back to June with Origins, we brought a moderately stable alpha build that, you know, kind of performed well. And, you know, there's been a lot of work plugged into it since then. And, Now, it's kind of our target window right now. As long as nothing really falls apart, we'll probably be there.
All right, before we dig too much into discussion of the game itself, we've got, of course, three members of the team here. Rob, you're the AI dude, correct?
Yes. Yep. I do a lot of the user interface as well, but I did the AI. And another member of our team, William van der Steren, has literally published articles on computer game AI, and I've managed to talk him into taking a bigger interest in this part. Normally he's our image scientist, but he's also turning into our AI guy, and we're really excited about that.
All right.
You got so, an AI question?
Well, no, I'm wanting to break down sort of who's doing what so that the listeners have a sense of who's here representing the team on the call. And so you mentioned you're doing user interface stuff as well, so you've got the front end and then the very, very back end if you're doing some of the AI stuff.
That's correct. Yeah.
So all right.
Jim is our data guy. So everything relating to the research and ferreting out of all the data. And with that, he does a great deal of simulations and the calculations, and Jim can tell you a bit more. And Jeff joins in on that as well. And Jeff, as you might have gathered from the opening comments, has a wealth of practical experience. So he can say, here's how you would model, you know, this situation or that technique or this component of the overall battle. And the two of them are our sim guys that really kind of sweat the details and try and make all this come together. William is basically an image scientist. He does all our graphics. He's done some amazing new stuff you'll see in the new game. And also increasingly does AI work. We're kind of dividing that right now and moving it over in his direction. So that's four of us. We're all coders, all developers. Steve Overton, Mad Russian to many, is our scenario guy still. And he's done a terrific job. He's champing at the bit to get making scenarios again. Which he will be doing any week now. And that's why we can say, yes, the game will come out now, first or second quarter next year. And what? The sixth guy, if I may, is Charles Belva. And he's also served, has extensive experience actually in the theater at the time. And he does our QA work and spearheads up kind of the protecting the game as a game. You know, does it play well? Is it smooth? Does it create tension? Does it give a satisfying experience? Does it tell a story properly or not? So he and I work very closely together, refining and polishing and really sweating the details. And that's it. Pretty much anything that doesn't fall into one of the other five jobs ends up on my plate, and we just grind away. Been working extremely hard over the last 3 years to get all this to come together.
Let's be honest, Steve is off designing scenarios somewhere. He might not be doing them for your game right now, but you know, there's not a game alive Steve ain't designed a scenario for at some point. You can't hold him down. I suppose we should pause here briefly just to catch the rest of the world. Look, we've known each other for over a decade, like, you know, Rob and Jim and I have been doing stuff at Origins, me and Jim especially, going back. God, what was the first year we were doing stuff? 2007, 2006?
Seven, eight, somewhere in there.
Yeah, somewhere around there. Because I think six, I was just a speaker at the War College because I was still running my booth. And I think it was seven or eight, somewhere in there, that we started doing the Wargaming program together down there for through the War College. And then, Rob, I think I met you very shortly thereafter. And then Jeff, obviously later, once you joined kind of the Origins crew, once we blew up the full Wargaming program. So there's an assumed familiarity amongst us, what we're talking about. We're talking about the Flashpoint campaigns, computer games published by Matrix that are an evolution of the old Flashpoint Germany game. And so, Jim, the Flashpoint campaign series, what's the topic? What's the scale? Where does it take place? Who are you as the player? Give our listeners the quick overview of what it is, because you know, and I know that you know that I know, but they don't know.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, Flashpoint campaigns now. The new one is going to be Cold War, and the first module in the Cold War series will be Southern Storm. So that's why you hear us refer to Southern Storm and everything. We're looking at the 1980s. We're looking at, in this case, it's going to be kind of Southern Germany and the Southern Theater. The scale is the same as it was in Red Storm, 500 meters for the hex size. You're basically in control of regimental battalion size units. You can be a little bigger, a little smaller, depending on scenario. But you're playing as the commander. So you're giving the orders, you're positioning the troops, you're doing the work and letting the little AI computer minions take care of the business out on the battlefield. That's pretty much where Red Storm was, and we really haven't gone away from that. A lot of what we've done with Southern Storm is kind of refine some of the, I'll say, the sharper edges that we had with Red Storm. Some of that orders delays, the type and amount of orders, some of the AI play. So there's been some changes, and I'll let the other guys talk to some of that too, so I'm not hogging the microphone all the time.
So it's Cold War goes hot in Europe, and you're playing at the mid to high tactical level.
Right, yeah, what we consider grand tactical scale. So there'll be platoons and companies and some sections and, the individual unit here and there. We cover, aircraft, helicopters, WMDs. There's other fun bits and pieces in there as well.
But we're focused on ground combat. There's some air, but not it's not a focus of the game. And I think you acknowledge the existence of a Navy, but like they're not really in the game at all.
No, we try to keep it on land-based. I know some people have said, oh, hey, let's, bring it in over the ocean and onto land. It's like, we're going to stick with land for now.
Yeah.
Plenty of games out there doing that air-naval thing. And we'll just, at the moment, focus on the land bits.
Yeah. So, Jeff, right now, Flashpoint Campaigns, the original Red Storm is still available. It's a live game, and we're talking about the new stuff coming out. We're not talking about, there is nothing available. You can go get Flashpoint Campaigns and go play it today, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
and also the Germany Reforged DLC. So, there you go.
All right. So, when we're saying Cold War goes hot in Europe, have y'all... I know that it's sort of loosely the 80s. Have y'all specified a year cutoff somewhere in there that this is what we're shooting for? 83, 85, 89, what are we?
Most of the scenarios for Red Storm were in the 88, 89 range. But it's not to say that we can't, hit the entire decade. We picked the 80s because there's such a real change in equipment from basically 1980 to 1990, because you go from, limited night vision in through thermal sights, which was a, force multiplier for NATO in that time frame. You go from an M60 to an M1 to an M1A1. Russian equipment also kind of steps up over that time period. It's just a very, fascinating point in that timeline, and the game will allow you to cover it. We'll probably center again on the latter portion of the 80s, where it's more entertaining, but that's not to say you won't see some other scenarios or things that could be played out earlier in the decade.
And there's also a significant table of organization equipment change that happens from 82 to 87 with those units in Europe as well, as a part of the shift from the M60 series equipment to the M1 series equipment, and going from M113s to M2s and M3s. It's a pretty big shift there as well.
Yeah, but that's kind of why we kind of centered on it. There's a lot you can definitely do in that time period.
So, Jeff, look, you don't, make it all the way up to being the divisional master gunner just, in a week and a half. Were you in Europe in the 80s in a tree suit?
Yeah, it sure was. My first tour was down at Vicenza in the first of the 509th. And then in 1990, I was assigned to the 8th Infantry Division at Mannheim. It was a 113 unit. And then the following year, we transitioned to Bradley's. So, and that's an interesting point you bring up about the TO&E changes. You know, having gone through one of those TO&E changes, it's a scenario designer's dream, because you know, in that period of like 85 to 90, you know, you can historically justify any kind of unit you want and just about any kind of TO&E, you know, because the TO, you know, a change in the organization, a change in the equipment is not an instantaneous thing. You know, it takes a battalion, you know, well past 6 months to do that kind of conversion. And it's not just converting M60s to M1s or Bradleys into, you know, 113s into Bradleys. There's things like the mortars are reorganized, and you've got a whole company that was the anti-armor company with improved tow vehicles getting switched over to Bradleys. And so, you know, you could say, well, this happened, you know, and here's this battalion that was halfway through its changeover. Okay. So, you know, what does that mean? Well, yeah, the company 81 millimeter mortar squads were gone out of the companies and they got moved to the headquarters companies. But guess what? They don't have their four deuce mortars yet. So you've got a battalion mortar platoon that's got 81s. And you could do things like that. It's very a lot of creative opportunity there to do things like that that just look flaky. But historically, those, you know, units were in transition, and it took time to do that. And so you could have a battle, you know, you could put together a battle that would have a wide variety of equipment capabilities on both sides. You know, a lot of folks would tend to think like, oh, 1989, everybody's got M1s, everybody's got Bradleys, you know, and that's the way it was. Well, not really. So it's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, and you've just given every loggie a heart attack out there, because now they got to figure out which ammo to actually put on the truck. but I think you bring up an interesting point with the TO&E changeover. It's not simply a matter of, here, let me sign over the old gear, walk across the motor pool and go sign for the new gear, and then I'm off and running. Like, there's a significant amount of train-up involved in all of that as well, because the gunnery tables are not the same for the guys that are training, you know, live rounds inside those Bradleys, inside those M1s. Like, I don't even – did you ever actually shoot a gunnery off of an M113 vehicle? I mean, was that even a thing?
Yeah, you had tables. I mean, when I first got to 48 Infantry in Mannheim, I was a squad leader. So I didn't do the 113 crew qualification table, the driver and the you know, the E5 TC. But later on, as you go through your gunnery tables, you have a series that are at the crew level, and then you get ones that are at the platoon level. Okay, and so yeah, even in a 113 equipped unit, you still had a platoon qualification table, and that was everybody.
Yeah,
and the same thing, you know, and they had a table laid, a crew qualification table, and it was for the 50 cal.
Okay, I didn't ever remember seeing a 113 gunnery go off at any point. I've done Bradley gunnery, I've done M1 gunnery, I've watched M60 gunnery, The point being that
it's a lot more simplified, given that all you've got is a machine gun.
Yeah.
You know? And so that makes the gunnery table tables a little bit easier.
Only so much you can do.
But
for people listening that have never seen one of these or been a part of it or been through one of these, like I said, it's not as simple as just walking across the motor pool with the new equipment and suddenly your unit's good to go. Like, there's a significant train up involved. One of the bare bones things that becomes a really big deal for any unit that's never been around M1s, when the M1s show up, people don't realize what a fuel hog those things can be. And it's always hilarious when you have infantry guys that have never really been around the tanks to realize, holy crap, they need a lot of gas. You know, a tank burns a gallon a minute, whether it's moving or sitting still. That's a lot of fuel that those jet engines suck up in those tanks. So, you know, what you're saying is...
And the other thing with that, when you transition to a new piece of equipment like that, is, like you said, there's significant training. Well, it's like more than that. You have to, like, go to school. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole company would go to Grafenwehr, and they had a new equipment training team set up there, you know, with a company set of Bradleys and, you know, gunnery simulators and all this stuff. And you went to go learn how to operate your new vehicle. And it was like a month-long thing, you know. And, like, the first thing is, okay, everybody's going to get a driver's license. You're going to do driver training, you know. And then you start breaking down into, you know, crew simulations and whatnot. And I went through two transitions. I went one I was piggybacked with another unit because I was tapped to go to master gunner school. So first I had to get reclassified as a Bradley infantryman. And so I went with another unit to their transition. And then I went through two transitions for different companies in my battalion when we started transitioning from 113s to Bradleys. And so, and then beyond that, then you have maneuver training.
Yep.
It culminates, you know, in a battalion rotation. So it's like a year-long process to cut that stuff over.
Yeah, and so, like, it's easy to say, hey, this unit's got their new gear, go have fun, but that doesn't mean they know how to use it. And I think that's part of the key there is, you know, while the crew can take a little bit of time to learn how to work the tank, great, but M1 ops are not M60 ops, and Bradley ops are not M113 ops. And so the time it takes for the platoons and companies and battalions to develop some proficiency for how to go do this, you know, you mentioned that you could put together whatever kinds of equipment sets you want in the game. But as a part of that, sort of like where or if are you modeling any of that train up, that competency that comes with sliding from one set to another?
Well, that's part of the characteristics of the units in the game. You know, there's some things we call the soft factors, and one of those is training level. So you have training, you have readiness, which is dynamic, and it's kind of an aggregation of equipment state and fatigue of the members of the unit, and it goes up and down as you give them orders and have them do things, and they fight and they rest, and the last one being morale. So. And again, this is just another, you know, dimension of the creativity you can have during this time frame. You know, I've got a company, and their training level is significantly lower than the training level of the other companies, and the battalion level is, you know, the battalion headquarters. Well, that's not all that great, you know. And why? Well, then your backstory is, well, you've got two companies that transitioned 6 months prior. You've got two companies that just completed transition, and the battalion has yet to do a maneuver certification at a training center with their new equipment. And so then you say, wow, you have this, you know, it's not, you know, the typical 70% across the board that you might see otherwise, you know, which is just like your trained to standard, you know, common troops. You know, you've got some guys that are trained to standard, you got some guys that are substandard. And a lot of folks would be like, what do you mean there's Americans that are substandard? You know, and that's very possible to have happen.
This is one of the real delights of working on this game, this era. We collectively decided to make, you know, a Napoleonic game. We wouldn't have Grognard, you know, writing to us and saying, oh, you got the details of the uniform wrong or anything like that. Doing a modern war game, you do get people. That's how Jeff joined the team, was exactly, oh, okay, I know how this works. Let me explain it. And we've had people write from all over the place. One of my favorite letters was from somebody who'd been in the Soviet forces at the time. And he got the game not expecting very much, and he was actually able to win with it. And he was so delighted that he wrote us a letter. It was wonderful.
Yeah, I guarantee if you got a detail wrong in a Napoleonic game, you would still get letters. Not from somebody who was there, obviously, but from somebody who would pretend they were. Quite frankly, probably from our site, you would get a few of them.
Yeah, that'd be Ocharski.
Yeah, yeah, that the buttons weren't sufficiently squared. One of the columns that I wrote a while back was actually about wargaming, the soft factors, and you mentioned, you know, U.S. units that are substandard. How dare we? The fact is, we know some units aren't as good as others. Like, that's not a secret. One of the things that I used to always advocate, and nobody was ever going to listen to a lieutenant anyway, but even once I was in defense contractor land, nobody ever wanted to approach this. Jeff, you've been on a lot of ranges. You've seen a lot of gunnery. You've seen some units that were really shit hot, and you've seen some units that, you know, thank goodness we tell them where the range fans are so they got a general sense of the direction they're supposed to shoot, and even then you sort of hope and pray. There, within things like the Janus exercises, the official military exercises, I really think there should be a variable that assigns your kill value based on your gunnery scores. Like, there's no way the commander could argue with the fact that Charlie Company's gunnery scores aren't as good as Bravo Company, therefore, guess what? Charlie's not going to shoot as straight. Right? Get over it. You want a better PK value in the sim when you go to the sim center? Shoot better on the gunnery range. Like, that gives you a minimum quantifiable something that you can say, Bravo Company's better than Charlie Company, they're going to perform better in the game. You know, and we have a measurable to prove it. We went to the gunnery range and they shot better. There's one thing you could do. Jim, when you're plugging these things into the database, how much of this are you looking for those measurables, you know, the physics of the game, right? Armor thickness, round velocity, whatever, versus those soft factors that Jeff was talking about, the commander quality, the train-up time that people have had with their equipment, things like that.
Well, I think that's kind of the nice thing that we've got put together with the game and with, you know, Rob's work on the original Flashpoint Germany is you can go in and put in all the hard data factors. You know how hard a M1's gun is going to punch at a given distance. You know roughly how accurate systems are. You know, there's a lot of wonderful curves, and I've got them in spreadsheets everywhere that, you know, here's the, you know, PK fall off and even the PH, the hit probabilities, how they roll off at range versus muzzle velocity versus type of round. And you can plug all these things in and you can sit there and get decent, I'll say, physical real world value out of it. But yeah, the correct point is, yeah, then you've got to look at the soft factors, and we have, you know, built into the code in the various places that, yeah, that unit that's, you know, 90%, they're the best of the best, it's going to show in the game because they're more of their shots are on target, they're reacting quicker to the environment, they're, you know, picking up targets quicker. And the other units that, you know, like Jeff said, if you had a unit in there that's, you know, not so hot, you know, low training, you know, low readiness, low morale, they slow down, they don't shoot as well, you know, their shots, you know, they panic fire more. We try to take a lot of that soft factor build in there. So if you run a scenario and you put guys in there with 90% training, 70% training, 50% training, and keep rerunning the scenario, you'll see the better guys be better. You know, equipment and, you know, technology can only take you so far. And even in, you know, if you're in an aircraft dropping a precision weapon, we look at the readiness of the pilot, the stress on the pilot, to even, you know, be able to employ the ordnance properly.
What, so, what a novel concept that the better units would perform better.
Yeah, and it changes over the course of the game, too, because we portray battles typically 4 to 8, and units keep moving at speed and then living in a, you know, the hyper-lethal battlefield of the day. We're operating under a lot of stress, and they fatigued quickly. And you can see that as you play at the game. At the beginning, everybody's organized. They move off smartly when you give orders. But as losses happen and they get run ragged and never getting a break, things slow down. And you can get sort of a lengthening command loop between the time you give your orders and the time the troops on the ground actually finally get on their objectives. And so as a player, you have to rest your troops. You have to be cognizant that you've pushed them hard, and now they need a break. They need to resupply. They need to just get their fatigue levels back to a reasonable state. And if you ignore that, you get creamed. we're very explicit about that. That's an important part of the game.
So you mentioned the command loop, and I think this is an important thing because I know this is one of the key distinguishing features of the Flashpoint campaign series relative to everybody else. It is a turn-based game, but the turns are not necessarily symmetric, for lack of a better term. There is a difference in who gets to do what during the turns. Kind of explain, like, the actual game effect, like how that manifests in the game when I, as a player, am sitting there looking at it, but sort of also expand on how you came to that.
That's you, Rob. Go.
Yeah.
That's me. Okay. I forget where the inspiration for that came, but it's quite possibly from a conversation at Origins with Eric Rutens of Matrix Games fame. And we were kicking ideas around because I wanted to model that and didn't quite know how to do it. And the concept at a grand tactical level like this is that you might have a turn as commander every 15 minutes. And what you do is you give your orders. And it might take 15 minutes for those orders actually to disseminate down the command hierarchy for the people, to stub out their cigarettes and mount up into the machines and actually get going. And then it might take half an hour to go from point A to point B, at which point they'll finally launch an assault and secure a town or a village. And we didn't want to start, stop, start, stop. We wanted, it's 8 o'clock in the morning, 0800, give your orders. And those orders might take an hour or an hour and a half to do. And then the turn will tick over every 15 minutes, and you'll watch that hour and a half order progress and be fulfilled. And when the units finally arrive, they'll go into hold, say, or screen mode, and then wait for the next order cycle to come up. And that worked pretty well. Those were persistent orders. We were then thinking, not every army is the same. And that was a particular feature of the Cold War. The Soviet forces did an incredible number of battle drills, so they could get very fast reactions to standard orders. And if a non-standard order came up, say a battalion hasty attack in a direction they hadn't thought of, that might take 6 hours. Not in our game, but in real life. It was just, they were flummoxed. They weren't ready for it. They didn't have enough people to actually cut orders and figure everything out and disseminate them and get them going. So wildly different kind of lengths of the command cycle. We're saying, how can we model that? We looked at the game and said, actually, it's not that hard. We will set it up. So we look at how many headquarter units you have, how proficient they are, what the average readiness of everybody is, and come up with a number. And if you've got lots of headquarters units and you're well-rested, 15-minute turns. If you've taken a beating and people are have gaps in the headquarter ranks and the units of readiness is running down, it might be a 30-minute thing, a 30-minute turn cycle for them. And so we have a game queue. It's like a rail, and you just drop all these events and sequence on it. And the orders phases are just another kind of event. And so you can have them. So, the American player, the first player, the blue player, will go 15 minutes. And the Soviet adversary might be on a 19-minute cycle. And so at minute 15, the American can put in his second set of orders. It plays another 4 minutes. You get to the 19-minute mark, the Soviet player puts in his. And away they go. And as the average readiness of the forces and the other factors that we count for this change during the battle, usually for the worse, each turn kind of stretches out. And your turn might end up being like an hour apart. And it's just because your forces are so bedraggled and so spread out and fatigued, they simply can't react anymore to your orders in a timely way. What you then have to do is rest them up again, and you'll see your command cycle then shortening up again. Might not go back to 15 minutes, but it might well go under half an hour. And that can make the difference. That's what happens in real life, we believe. There are any number of battles where the commander knew exactly what to do and could see what was happening, but he couldn't put it into effect in time. There's that orders delay. This, you observe, you orient, you decide, and you act. And you might be all chipping, you know, full of vim and vigor and energy, but if your forces aren't, it just takes too long. It happens too late, and you lose the battle. And so a big part of this game is kind of managing the length of that loop. Oh, sure, I could attack everywhere with everything, but my command cycle would go from about 15 minutes to, you know, an hour, and then I'd be stuck. The guy would be able to have multiple command turns within that, get inside my decision loop, and run rings around me. All I could do is watch. That's kind of the thinking behind that.
And let's be honest, anybody that is hearing this and thinking, oh, it takes about an hour to plan something, and thinking that that seems a little long, I dare you to come to Origins and participate in one of our command post exercises, and let's see just how fast that hour goes by.
So. Hollywood, yeah. There's the Hollywood numbers, and then there's the real life numbers. And we kind of steer in the middle, I would say. If we used real numbers, that would be such a slow-moving game, it wouldn't be any fun.
Yeah.
But it's definitely not, oh, it takes just 5 minutes to get, you know, a battalion on the road and into the action. No.
There is another piece of friction that the game mechanic captures very nicely if you're not experiencing the effects yourself. And that's commanders who frequently change their minds. And,
oh, yeah.
We don't know any of those guys.
It's like a new order to a unit every command cycle that's, you know, different. And what happens is that unit's readiness just keeps dropping and dropping because every time you give somebody an order, they've got to respond to it, and it has a readiness cost. And, you know, okay, great, you're an American, and you're everybody's in good shape, you know, headquarters-wise, so you've got nice short command cycles, and you just keep hammering everybody with different orders every time because you saw a new unit, and you've got to do something about it, you know. And I've watched players and player teams do this at Origins where they just, you know, it's like, okay, plan 99, you know, plan 101, plan 250, you know, every single orders phase. And they, you know, it's like, I don't understand why my command cycle is getting worse and worse and worse. We're not even in contact yet, you know, and that's what it does is it's capturing the, you know, drop what you're doing and do this instead and what that does to a unit.
Yeah. The squirrel distraction, right? Ooh, squirrel. And, run off and chase something different for a change. I could totally see that driving subordinates nuts because I've been one of those subordinates that's been driven nuts by that.
Yeah, and the other thing with the asymmetrical turns is that you really get punished if you allow yourself to be surprised. And I think that the game mechanic elevates the importance of reconnaissance and security as compared to other games out there. If you get surprised, you've probably lost at that point.
So I've talked about this plenty of times before on other podcasts. I'm firmly convinced that most tabletop games have no idea how to properly treat recon assets. In part because much of the job of the recon forces is done as soon as you open the box, right? I already know what the available enemy order of battle is as soon as I open the box. I don't have to try and send scouts out to confirm or deny the presence of enemy cavalry. I might want to find the enemy cavalry, but again, I'm on a board game. They're sort of there. Like, even if I as a commander wouldn't really know they're there, it's kind of hard to hide a stack of blue counters over the other hill. That's obviously something that you guys can take advantage of in a digital world by just not showing those units until you actually run into them. And so that's, you know, I really think the computer game brethren have the tabletop guys' butts kicked in the accurate use of recon assets in your games. Jeff, I wanted to ask a question specifically for you as the dude who spent time in the service.
Okay, send it.
Well, so Rob had mentioned that, you know, there's the Hollywood numbers and there's the real numbers, and you guys are trying to sort of shoot the middle for some of these things. Do you have an example of a time where you sort of, you know, shot a flare up and said, hang on, guys, that's not how it really works in the real world? And everybody else said, yeah, but if we do it your way, the game is going to suck. I know they exist. Now, you may not want to admit to one in public, but I know these things exist.
There's a couple of them. Like, the first one, it will be one of my earliest forum postings was talking about missiles on Bradleys. And the thing is, yeah, you've got a 2-round launcher, but then it's going to take you a couple of minutes to reload that. And while you're reloading, you really can't do anything else. And it just turns into a really very complicated model compared to, say, like a tank. It's just really hard to do. All right, so that's an example of one of those where we stuck with a simplification in order to avoid some complexity in both what the player would, you know, have to experience and the model difference, and then implementing it in code would be a pretty big lift, and we just stuck with that. Another one would be ammunition. And in particular, it's ammunition resupply for artillery units. Okay, so since artillery units are hopefully never in line of sight of the enemy, and don't have to worry about that, they do resupply differently than a tank platoon or a mechanized infantry company. You know, a mechanized, you know, the line guys will have resupply pushed to them in packages. And then they'll, you know, spend a half an hour cycling vehicles through to get refueled and rearmed and pick up some chow. The artillery does it differently. They've got, you know, their own ammo carriers, and they basically have a continuous conveyor of ammunition being pushed to them. So there really isn't a discrete, this artillery unit needs to get more ammo, because it's. And if things are working correctly and you haven't lost, you know, a bunch of transport or something, then that's going to, that resupply is a continuous thing. And again, that just, it really adds a level of complexity into something that we have consciously decided we want to minimize the complexity of logistics. And that's just a design decision that we made. And there's other areas where we made those kind of design decisions in terms of, you know, for Red Storm. Engineering is another one where we've abstracted, we've simplified, and subsequently we changed our mind about it.
Having been a logistics guy, can you find a way to simplify it in the real world?
No, you can't. I mean, it's complex. and you go back and look at Desert Storm, and there were some very real doctrinal problems in the U.S. Army with artillery units, and the ones in case in point would be corps level artillery. They didn't have that conveyor system set up for them, so the ammo carriers for corps artillery units, well, they drew their ammo not from a brigade support area, not from a division ammo transfer point. They drew it like dockside. So they had to go all the way back to the theater level ammunition supply point, and that's how they got their ammo. And so what you saw in Desert Storm was, in many, many cases, corps artillery units only ever had their initial basic load and never got an ammo resupply. And that's because there was a hole in the doctrine and in the resultant TONE for those guys.
It was a little different for the MLRS guys. For the cannons, you're absolutely right. The MLRS guys was a little different world. And I have a little bit of insider knowledge on that one because the brigade operations officer for the 212th Brigade that was supporting the 24th Infantry Division in Desert Storm was MLRS heavy. That brigade was MLRS heavy. That brigade operations officer, I have him programmed into the phone. I call him Dad. I do want to ask, and I know that there's a limit to what you guys are allowed to talk about here. Matrix Games, your guys' publisher, has signed an agreement with the UK Ministry of Defense, DSTL, the Defense Science Technology Lab, to provide some gaming resources to help train the UK forces. And Command Modern Air Naval Ops was part of that package. You guys were a part of that package. To the extent that you may know or not know how some of the deal came about, but more importantly, like your guys' involvement in what's coming up and how you're tailoring some things for them, what can you tell us without having to stab us afterwards? Rob, what if anything, can you guys reveal on this?
Well, we were totally delighted, of course, to be recognized by these people. They play war games. Who knew? But apparently they do. Fans of the game. They want less emphasis on the Cold War and more, I would say, on the modern era. So a whole lot of work for Jim to get modern data in. And, of course, times have changed a lot. The Cold War was really before battlefield computers. They started having precision-guided munitions. They had thermal imaging. They had laser range fighters. But if you're talking modern, it changes enormously. And the game engine can handle it, but a lot of what they'd like us to see do is to incorporate, you know, slat armor and God knows what all into all these into the model. There's a lot of really interesting things. It's early days still, so we don't know where it's going to go. But they're spending most of their initial time basically understanding how the game works. Jim made reference to all the curves and data files and things he's got. That's the kind of thing they're interested in first. They want to validate it. They want to verify it. And from there, they want to be able to make maps and create their own data files. And they want us to be able to support kind of modern era capabilities in the game. Ask me in a year and I'll probably be able to give you some more concrete examples of what that amounts to.
So
I have a couple of comments on this. First, Brant, I'd like to make a correction. It's their interest isn't really in acquiring a training tool. Okay, the DSTL guys, these are operations research guys. What they're looking at from civilian games is a different viewpoint and different ways to look at the problems that they're analyzing. And the other thing that's appealing to them from the commercial game market is the fact that the UIs that we make, you know, not just us, but hobby game makers, period. The UIs that we make are much more intuitive. They're much more polished. They're just easier to use. It's easier to learn to operate the game than the ones that have been developed in the past, either, you know, in-house governmentally or under contract. And that's very attractive to them. Now, does that translate into someday somebody might want to use it as a training tool? Who knows? But as far as, you know, not taking a lot of resources out of HIDE to use a platform to do a study, that's very attractive. You know, you just need one guy to go play, you know, operate the game or set things up and can learn how to do that quickly as compared to, you know, some other kind of simulation that might entail, you know, a half a dozen contractors on site. And that's attractive to them, both from an expense standpoint and a time standpoint.
It's less training tool than more a combination of modeling tool and a bit of its own science project. Let's understand what we can gain from the civilian marketplace that we can apply on our side.
Yeah.
Okay. That and it's great to have you guys sort of correct that and explain that a little bit because, you know, let's face it, it hasn't been a voluminous amount of information come out other than, hey, we signed this deal, isn't this cool? And it's been sort of, we're providing games to the distal, but that's as far as really anybody had heard about any of this. And so obviously the default assumption is going to be training tools because that's the primary usage of these games within a military context. I think the modeling side of things absolutely is underreported within the hobby world. Those of us that have done this professionally know that that exists and that it's a very important piece of things, but it's not typically a use that we associate, that the hobby guys associate with what's going on in the military.
And you got to keep in mind that in distal, that last letter is lab, and that's what you know they're doing. They're experimenting.
So we're going to be teaching rats to play Flashpoint campaigns. And then testing the effects on their brain chemistry.
A lot of the value, of course, of gaming is just posing novel situations and practicing the decision-making process, you know, limited information and everything else. And that goes back to the reference you made earlier. Oh, no, I'm sorry, it wasn't made earlier. It was, Jeff, Commander Lacey, brings in civilian war gamers.
Yeah. Okay. So Jim Lacey, he's written. He's a professor at Marine Corps University, former Army infantry officer, my company commander when we were in recruiting command together, and he's written a number of articles: War in Iraq, Strategy, Bridge. I don't know if you wrote anything for the War Room at the War College, but in one of his articles, he feels very strongly about having wargaming be a formal part of professional military education. And he has his students play games as part of their coursework. And he thinks it ought to be done at all levels. Anyways, one of the things he does is he has civilian hobbyists come in and assist him in teaching people how to play games and conducting games. And what he has noticed is that we're talking about, you know, folks that have been battalion commanders in combat, very proficient in doing, you know, battalion-level tactical stuff, very successful, but they get routinely beaten by gamers with no actual military experience, and that really piqued his interest, and he took a look at that, and he came to the conclusion that while these folks, the civilians, you know, that doesn't mean that they're ready to be battalion commanders and whatnot, absolutely not. However, what they were able to do is, regardless of the game, regardless of the period, regardless of the game mechanics, they could consistently identify and correct responses to patterns in force concentration and use of terrain of different games over different eras. You know, and so where does that come from? Well, you know, a bunch of them, you know, a lot of them are, you know, well-versed in military history. So, yeah, they've got that going for them. But he felt that they're just – it's a pattern recognition, template recognition thing as a result of having played lots and lots and lots and lots of games.
Yeah, I was about to say that – look, we've both, you know, run around in uniform and we've both been hobby gamers. And well, quite frankly, I volunteered for as many extra opportunities as I could, especially in the National Guard when those opportunities would pop up to run around and help support a Janus exercise somewhere or help run one of those wargaming exercises somewhere along the way. And I did a handful of them for some of the officer professional development when I had an opportunity to lead some of those sessions. I dare say we get more games in one weekend at Origins than I got in 14 years in uniform. Mm-hmm. And so when you're talking about that pattern recognition just from repetition, hell yeah, absolutely. Because the hobby guys do this a hell of a lot more. Now, let's face it, part of it is those hobby guys aren't dealing with, you know, issues of military discipline. They're not trying to schedule guys to get to school. They're not trying to worry about professional development of their soldiers. They're not trying to run a motor pool. They're not trying to keep all their vehicles working. They're not busy doing an equipment transition from one set of equipment to a new set of equipment. They're not doing all these other things that military guys get tasked to do just as a part of their day job. And so, you know, hobby guys have a whole lot more opportunity to do that. But yeah, I mean, the repetition thing, I think, is absolutely a valid point there.
So when outfits like Distal start buying commercial war games, you know, that's the kind of thing they can start using them for, and they can start measuring that, investigating that, and actually seeing, you know, what they can get out of it. Tremendous shortcut. It's so much cheaper and quicker just to use something off the shelf that's reasonably close. Doesn't have to be perfect, but it's a heck of a lot quicker. The internal professional loop is sort of once every 3 years, you know, an officer might do a war game. No, you need it every weekend. You need you need a quick cycle to build up that skill.
I think, you know, putting on the contractor hat briefly from having had these conversations with some of the government guys that own the checkbooks, and having been in some of the exercise planning discussions, one of the issues is if it isn't perfectly modeled, you've built in an excuse for the participants when their unit underperforms in the system, right? I didn't lose because I made bad decisions. I lost because your game model isn't good enough. And so some of what gets built into these, what our good buddy Dr. Sterrett likes to call the self-licking ice cream cones, right? The giant JCATs and core battle systems of the world that take literally armies of contractors to run. They're not just job programs for retired majors. They are hugely complex because they're trying to account for every possible variable on the planet, almost as sort of defensive coding against excuses being made by the participants as to why they suck at what they're doing, right? It's never, you know, those guys never want to hear that they made a crappy decision if they can blame the game for something dumb that they did, you know, for something dumb the game did. And so that's where, you know, a hobby game like y'all's, you know, is immensely detailed. Is it sufficiently immensely detailed that it's got sort of built-in excuse Kevlar against somebody saying, well, I lost because the game didn't model something correctly, not I lost because I was an idiot and sent my artillery into direct fire range of the enemy. So, you know, Jim, I don't know how you model idiot Kevlar in the database there. How would we build that in?
I think what you get into is you can't. There's always going to be, you know, some error somewhere. You know, your data is only, in our case, is only as good as we can research it and find it in non-classified means. So, you know, our idiot proofing is, hey, our data is open. You can mod it. If you think that should have another 15 millimeters of penetration, go for it. You know, or the armor should be a little thicker, great. Or you should have this additional piece of equipment. You know, they can make the adjustments themselves to basically take away that excuse mechanism. You know, we've seen it with Red Storm. You have some people go, oh, yeah, this looks like it's spot on. Other people are going, you know, my M1 should be killing everything that walks onto the map. Well, don't know what to tell you. You know, numbers are numbers. Physics is physics. You know, if you don't like what you're seeing, you know, go in and adjust it till you're happy type of stuff. You know, and you kind of get the feeling, you know, having gone to Connections this year, that there's still some kind of bias against the computer simulation, computer modeling, that if you don't have a person, you know, there that can adjudicate what's going on and say, well, you know, that should have worked like that, and you weren't an idiot for moving them up there. You're kind of stuck. It's I think hard to get a computer game to be perfect. You can't simulate perfection in reality unless you have reality. So there's always going to be some, you know, corner that you're cutting, abstraction that you're making, that somebody's going to point out and go, well, you know, you didn't take into account today's dew point.
Yeah.
No, we didn't. Can't tell you.
Yeah, at some point you need the adult in the room who's you know, trying to keep people focused on what actually matters.
Right. And that's to kind of Rob's point earlier, too. It's and to the Sterrett comment, it's selective fidelity. What do you want this to do? And, you know, we'll tell you, yes, it can. No, it can't. You know, are you going to be able to solve every battle ever fought with our software? Probably not. You know, but it will do good at certain things. You can use it to train for certain things. You can use it, you know, to analyze certain data. But you've got to, you know, again, you know, it's a computer. It's only going to do what you put in.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've got to understand what goes in to understand what comes out.
Yep, yeah. And I think part of it is an understanding of what it is you're doing when you first sit down with whatever wargaming tool it is. You know, Jeff has drawn the distinction here between sort of modeling versus training, and that's a very valid one. There's also wargaming as a rehearsal tool. There's wargaming as a decision support tool. Let's try several courses of action and see which one we prefer. Like, that's built into the military decision-making process. There's wargaming as a familiarization tool. Hey, let's learn something about these concepts. There's wargaming as a military history learning tool. Hey, why did the Athenians go attack Syracuse when they needed to go the other way? Because the Turks were over there. The Persians were over that way. You know, that was one of Jim Lacy's articles in War on the Rocks, talking about the Peloponnesian Wars, the Persian Wars. There's any number of uses for war games that the tools to an outsider may appear very similar when you're glancing over at the table, but in fact you're doing very different things with them.
It's a scope issue. People have a tendency to not understand scope in a game. Like, if somebody walks up to us and says, well, I want to use your game to understand, you know, how many tons of ammo and food and fuel I'm going to burn if I have to go to war with country X for 6 months, we're going to be not what we do.
Yeah.
And then people go, oh, then what good are computer simulations? Well, we're not set up to do that. That's not the scope we're in. Now, if you want to look at it here in a defined single battle element thing, sure. If you want to start moving product, you got to look at a different program that's looking to do that. And again, it's not one size fits all, which I think people look at a computer and a program and go, well, it should be able to do everything. Not true.
So we've talked some about where the game is. So Flashpoint Campaigns Red Storm, available now. Go buy it. There's some extra DLC that you can go pick on that with. We've got Southern Storm, you said, first to second quarter of next year. So we're talking somewhere between January and Easter of next year. Is that what we're looking at?
I would say so, yeah.
Roughly-ish?
Roughly-ish, yeah. never want to stick a solid pin in that with software, but yeah, that's where we're...
Well, look, I've been hearing, yeah, it's a couple months away from you guys for like 2 years now.
For a
so.
While. Yeah, exactly.
we've got the distal contract is out there. Obviously not a ton you guys are allowed to talk about, but any sense of when some things will actually start happening with them that you guys might be able to share publicly? Are we talking a couple of months? Or are we talking like 2 years before we find out sort of some of the things that went on there of what you would even be allowed to talk about? Rob, do we know anything about that yet?
I'd say in 6 months we'll have a much better feel for that. It's still early days. We're still trying to get the right people talking to the right people and refining the talking points. We've done some work for them, but it's still early days. We have a pretty good idea of the big picture they're interested in. But we don't have the details yet.
They're blue sky. Some of their blue sky stuff is very fascinating. Can't share that, but it's very fascinating.
So I will say this. So, like, when you guys do actually have to get on a plane and go to England, if you need a translator, I'm happy to go with you. I would be more than willing to take some time off work to join you guys and offer my services for that. So we've got a version of the game available. We've got a newer, cooler, snazzier version of the game coming up. And then if you really want to see, well, not really, but if you kind of sort of want to see how this stuff all, you know, how a military staff makes this stuff go using your guys' game to help adjudicate everything, come see us at Origins next year. We're still planning on being there. We're still planning on having our command post exercises. And these are the guys that help run those, right? I mean, we've got the game operators on the line here. And like, we didn't even talk about that tonight because it was outside, you know, Jim, you mentioned scope. That's outside the scope of what we were here to discuss. Exactly. So, well, listen, guys, I appreciate y'all taking the time out of your busy evening and pulling you away from your keyboard coding. I know I've now just induced another 2-week delay in the code being delivered by talking to you guys for an hour tonight. But Rob, thank you very much. Especially,
it's
you know,
a pleasure, Brent.
Having to do Canadian conversion onto Skype and talk to us and everything. So. Jim, thank you for joining us, taking time away from rocket fuel calculations. And
one of those things I do.
And Jeff, thank you for being able to get your Skype actually working to be able to talk to us. So.
Been a pleasure.
All of these guys hang out with us in our forums on, you know, to varying degrees of frequency. But if you've got questions about the Flashpoint campaign series, they've got an official forum set up over at the Matrix Games website. But of course, we are much cooler over at the Armchair Dragoons, and so if you want to talk to the guys, you can do that over at our site as well. Thank you very much for joining us on Mention and Dispatches as Season 3 rolls along here. And then come back next Friday and join us for our next episode after this one. Guys, good night. Thank you very much. Listeners, thanks for joining us.